Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week, we feature a man who was one of the first contributors to a journal begun by founding editor Arthur Reynolds in 1964. He is a fisherman, author and former manager of Swan Nets, Seamus Hayden. Seamus has packed several exciting lifetimes into his working life. Many in the fishing and maritime communities will be familiar with his writings and his memoirs. A few weeks ago in Galway, at the archive exhibition at the Skipper Expo, Seascapes spoke to Seamus about his days as a fisherman. Siversen Trawl, the fledgling net-making company which grew to become Swan Nets, close encounters with the Russian fleet, and how Seamus Hayden came to be invited by Arthur Reynolds, founding editor of the Irish Skipper, to submit his first contribution 50 years ago.
Perhaps the fishing industry didn't get the focus it needed until the Skipper was founded. In 1964, I was on the point of abandoning the industry. I had tried to go ahead, didn't make it, had hoped to get married, and found that this man Arthur Reynolds, had sent a copy of the first Skipper in February 1964 to the address my parents had a shop in, a business, and that they had to sell 7 years before. So I went and met him. And I talked about different things, said that I could write an article for him about lobster fishing and crab fishing. So he said, would you write me something about the crab fishing? And my first article for the Skipper was in April 1964, in which I suggested that Ireland could have a sustainable crab fishing industry of perhaps 20,000 tonne a year. Well, we didn't quite make that, but some years ago we hit 17,000. So I think I can feel with pride some justification. And in this year, where we've had unprecedented storm and wind at sea, particularly in the west and southwest at corners, it must have been devastating. But I was interested here in this archive room yesterday. First two people came in to me as we're talking and inquiring about things in general, and we got talking about crab. And I mentioned when I had crewed with a friend of mine, Micheál Canning, on the Ros Nuala in 1962. The Ros Nuala was one of the boats sold off when Brendan O'Kelly took over at BIM. Sold off cheap. Gay Lynn bought it, and they wanted us to fish lobster this time of the year for a freezing plant in Carna. And lobster were scarce. And we ventured further south and into the Maharees area, where we found plenty of crab and plenty of spider crab. And these first two gentlemen yesterday were from the Maharees, and they talked about how the spider crab fishery developed. Then later they managed to get Vivier boats in, and they had trucks and everything else. But at a time when the industry, men in the industry, took to fishing tangle nets for crayfish, that pretty decimated the spider crab population. And since then, he drew my attention to the fact that there are too many pots in the water at the moment. While it was marvellous for this crab fishing that I had such an interest in all those years ago, if we just trounce it too heavily, we're in danger of losing it. Back in 1963, as I had travelled to Flamborough in Yorkshire, to have a look at the fishing there. The Yorkshire fishery for crab had peaked at about 5,000 tonne a year, but by the time I was there investigating it, it had dropped back to 1,000. And they were very careful in Yorkshire with the fishery, but they still have it. In a mild criticism of Arthur, and I've great time for him and we're great pals still, that Arthur didn't like to challenge the establishment too much. And while he did so in his own quiet way, sometimes people like me felt that a more direct approach might have been more effective. But one of the things that I've learned at in a lifetime in the industry, where I was fortunate to be recruited, being selected as on the first eight men to go forward for a skipper training scheme in 1958. And seven of us completed the course and ended up with the first second-hand special certificates ever issued from Dublin. As myself, by chance, getting the number one, Gregory Keneally, Lord have mercy on him, getting the number two. And some of the others have passed away since then. I became aware how wonderful this fishing industry is. I was fascinated not just by the fact that you could possibly earn a living from it. I was fascinated by the creatures that we see. When I was with Micheál Canning, again, he was one of the seven who got their tickets in 59. When I was with him on the Ross Nool and we tried along the back of Arden, we came across a creature one day where in the 50-footer, it was so calm, we were hanging onto the cliff by holding the kelp. And in the kelp was a particular kind of sea cucumber that I never saw before and I never saw since. And the two Connemara lads that were on the crew with me on the deck, they instantly put a name to it, Budleke. And I'll give no prizes for the translation of what that might be in English, but it was apt.
There's a wonderful shot behind you here as we're sitting in this room of Ku Fassa and other misadventures.
Yes.
And it's something I'm sure you're very proud of, but you've been quite prolific on that front.
After I got my ticket in 59, I went back to sea and injured a knee, went over to my folks in England, and when my knee mended, got on a research boat as a relief man in Scotland. Stayed at another few months on one of the protection cruisers and then applied for a job on the Ku Fassa. I knew there was a new research boat in the offing. Sean Moriarty, Lord of Mercy of the board, got a message to me to phone him, and I phoned him from Inverness. And he said, I think you can take it, Jim. Jim is what they called me those days. You won't be considered for the job as skipper. He said, would you take a job on the deck? And I said, I will. But I came back to Dublin, and eventually the cook and three deck crew set off to join the boat in Holland where it had been built. But we returned back from London. Something was wrong. The boat had a permanent list at the quayside. So alterations had to be made. The boat had, to my mind, been restricted in length so that it could fish partly commercially inside the new baseline, the 3 mile baseline limit. And that spoilt her. She wasn't entirely a safe boat. And after a couple of years' experience, she was restricted to fishing only in 4-6 or less. So that was a pity. And that's why I entitled that particular book of memoir, The Ku Fassa and Other Misadventures. But of course, I was author of a lot of my own misadventures. No, it's far from solitary, but you were in a great sense at on your own. You faced the possibility of death or serious injury even when you think you are being careful. that in my last season fishing in Dunmore East on the Ardyme, skippered by Arcloman Ronan Mallon, that I was almost killed four times. And I started to think, maybe I'm not cut out to be a fisherman. But shortly after that, Liebig's Ireland Limited, who had built the second commercial accelerated freeze-drying plant in the world in Sligo, on the Quay in Sligo, asked me to travel to Devon to investigate a crab fishing operation in Paignton, Brous Brothers. And I must say at this stage about the Mr. Morris Brous that I met, he was the most generous man with information that I think I've ever come across. And then later that year, I travelled back and fished in the cock crab fishery off Start Point for a week or so on a 65-footer. And then later went to Flamborough, where I fished off the North Landing in Flamborough Head in Yorkshire Cobbles. But in the meantime, I found out I perhaps had been a bit indiscreet and I'd trodden somebody's toes. And I was trying to overcome difficulties. But a new venture in BIM under the stewardship, I suppose, as it were, of James M. O'Connor, who had transferred from the Department of Fisheries into the board in Brendan O'Kelly's time, negotiated with Liebig's a deal in which I would supply the expertise and the crew, and we initiated crab fishing in Sligo. After a mishap, an engine blew up in one boat on me. We initiated it in 1963 in Sligo, and it was from that experience that when Arthur Reynolds founded the Skipper in 64 and I approached him and met him, that I suggested that I would write this article about the crab fishing. And at that time, I had applied for a job as fisheries officer in East Africa, as with the Crown agents. And I was offered the job, gave me the chance to get married. And as I say in the last of the three books I have on this disc of mine now, after I married, I never fished again. A brother of mine had suggested when I returned from East Africa that I gain some experience in management, and I went into industry in England, but had moved in that time in the early 70s back to Donegal. I was working on the industrial estate in Gweedore, and I was a spectator really. I was made redundant later in 1974, and after a couple of years applied answered an advertisement in the Irish Times to a box number that looked for an assistant manager for a progressive trawl factory. And that took me into Severson Trawl, which later became Swannet Limited. And I was proud to be part of Albert Swan's team that built Swannet Limited into the top net makers in the world. And in that time, was very conscious of the wall that Irish fishing had hit at that time. In the pelagic end, Irish fishermen had become the masters of the world of that technique. Seamus Tully, a fisherman who is very reticent about his name being used even, that was a leading light. He was the man who wanted to go a step beyond, and the initiative he took in looking for a dedicated midwater trawler in 1977-78 led eventually to the new super trawlers that came just at 1980 and the start of the mackerel fishery. And there's much more to it than that. Swannet Limited became the gear supplier above all that provided the gear that made those boats successful. And the skippers that had learned such skills on the west coast of Ireland were the ones who went out and mastered the ocean. As they made catches eventually when the next generation of boats came along in the mid-80s. They made catches that are world records. And as I would explain to visitors that came into us from abroad where we ventured to America to sell nets, that these boats had to travel away and they wanted to feed the factories in Killybegs, so that when they took a haul, I used to use my two hands and reach out and grab, one boat would have to take one catch that was big enough to go home with, and the other one then take the other. And there was no discarding stuff. Everything came back to the factory, and that's how it should be. Going back a bit into the 70s, at the time I was made redundant from GT Carpets up on the industrial estate in Gweedore, at Howard Kinley, who was editor of Management Magazine, asked me if I would review the fisheries development plan that had been put together by the Irish Fishermen's Organisation. And I wasn't greatly taken with it. And I suggested to him that the only plan that made sense was that a fisherman should board everything that he catches. He should then land everything that he has taken on board, and he should market and sell everything that he lands on the pier. And that is the only fishing plan that makes sense to me.
You are listening to Seascapes, the maritime programme on RTÉ Radio 1, and our guest is author and former fisherman Seamus Hayden, also known to many as Jago Hayden.
The mackerel fishery is one that I looked at when I was putting together this fishing memory of mine, because growing up in Greystones in County Wicklow, we had a tradition of boats going away to the Kinsale herring fishery. And as I researched it, I found the truth of that, and that at one stage there were seven steamers carrying fish, fast steamers carrying fish from the Kinsale grounds to the West English ports, that's Cornwall and Devon perhaps, to the railheads where they were railed into London. And there were ships coming from Norway loaded with ice to ice the vessels down. But round about 1923, the American government embargoed imports of fish. And that killed the old traditional mackerel fishery. And while the drift net fishery persisted in the southwest, as I learned of it only in that marvellous counting system that they had. So many casts and so many extra, so that 100 fish could easily become 140 fish that the dealer was getting. That still existed when I was fishing myself. I must say that from the day that I joined Albert Swan as manager of this fledgling net factory, it was something special. As I stopped in digs in Killybegs for the first year and would travel back to Falcarra where I had settled with my family. And after 4 weeks with Albert, as I came home on the Friday evening and I said, I'm fulfilling another man's dream, but I'll go along for the ride. And all I can say is, what a ride it was. As I was on the Ardyme, we had been fishing that night just a little bit southwest of Dunmore. We'd made a small shot of herring and had cleared the deck. And we spotted close to us a larger lugger lying in the water. with fish on the deck and a bag over the side. And I figured it was inside the new baseline. And it wasn't a Dutch vessel, and it wasn't a German vessel. And it was a little while before I twigged that it was a Russian. I had seen some Russian vessels in Shetland, when I was in Shetland earlier. But I had also served time on a fishery protection cruiser in Scotland, and I had been on exercises where we steamed with lights out. I was on the deck, and I suddenly spotted a ship coming out of the dark, and I said to the skipper, "Don't move away just yet, we're going to have a bit of fun." And the Maeve suddenly put her lights on, flashed an Aldous lamp at the Russian, who didn't answer. And then the Maeve came on the loudhailer, and they asked the vessel to stop. And the Russian was still trying to edge away slowly outside. And finally, when he kept going, there was an almighty bang, and a tracer shell flew out across the bow of the Russian trawler. At more recently, when I was researching at a book I have written, I found a blog from an Irish Navy personnel who talked about the event where they fired a 4-inch shell at the Russian. I also came across a page from a newspaper in New York some 4 days later. I think it was in Yonkers. And I think it was the Yonkers Herald Statesman, some name like that, with a humorous piece about the 25 Russian sailors who would now be learning to eat corned beef and cabbage in an Irish jail. And they said that Khrushchev will no longer be concerned with how many divisions the Pope has. He'll be asking the question, how many ships have the Irish Navy?
Seamus Hayden, author and former fisherman, and one of the Irish skipper's first contributors in 1964. Here, then, are the words of Arthur Reynolds, who writes, "In a way, it could be said that the origin of the skipper began on the Shannon at Athlone, when a boy of 8 caught his first fish, a rudd, and lost others because his father had cut the barb off his hook to avoid pain. That was me, and there followed fish kept in tanks and angling in Dublin Bay, but my commercial interest began when I made a small draft net to catch minnow shoals to sell salted to an angler's shop for pike and trout bait." Arthur Reynolds and all those involved in the past 50 years on the Irish Skipper, we salute you. St Michael's Rowing Club in Dunlira are looking for your help over the May Bank Holiday weekend. The club have teamed up with Gol to send 2 crews across the Irish Sea to take part in the biennial Celtic Challenge. The race starts off from Arklow in County Wicklow with the finishing line in Aberystwyth in Wales. At a distance of 150 kilometres, this relay race is billed as the longest true rowing race in the world. St Michael's Rowing Club need help in finding support boats and a support rib for the Celtic Challenge. If you can help them, then contact Gareth Whittington on 086 044 7241. That's 086 044 7241. Or you can email him at Gareth, that's G-A-R-E-T-H, at finraiders.com. finraiders.com. Or Dunlira Rowing are on the book of the face. You'll also find the details on the Seascapes webpage, www.rte.ie/radio1/Seascapes. The RV Celtic Explorer left Galway last weekend for Newfoundland and Labrador on its 4th multi-institution transatlantic survey. The 13-day expedition across the Atlantic to St John's and Newfoundland will involve 4 scientists from NUIG Galway, as well as students from UCC and GMIT. A team of 6 scientists, led by Dr. George Rose from the Fisheries and Marine Institute of Memorial University Newfoundland, will work alongside 9 Irish scientists during the voyage. this collaboration with Newfoundland and Labrador builds on the strong relationship established since the first Newfoundland survey on the Celtic Explorer back in 2011. Irish scientists on board will study the rich and diverse pelagic ecosystem across the Atlantic Ocean. Scientists from Galway Mayo Institute of Technology will study plastics found in the ocean. Microplastic debris is made up of tiny plastic granules, fibres and fragments less than 5 millimetre in diameter. Although plastics are beneficial materials, microplastics appear to be pervasive in the ocean, and scientists do not yet fully understand the impact that small plastic particles can have on the food chain. Ingesting the tiny particles may be toxic to the animals and may prevent them from consuming their natural prey. Seabird and marine mammal observations will also be conducted by Aoife Foley from Galway Mayo Institute of Technology and Ashley Bennison from University College Cork. These animals are considered top predators in the pelagic environment, and the abundance of fish and zooplankton, their prey, ultimately affects their distribution and survival. Next Friday night here on Seascapes, we feature the legendary folk singer and troubadour on his love of the sea. Ralph McTell tells Marcus Connaughton on Seascapes about how he came to write Around the Wild Cape Horn, inspired by the exploits of Irving Johnson. How Jim McCann's tale of a family's loss at sea inspired The Grey Sea Strand, and the legacy of that composition recorded by both Ralph and Jim. And A Kiss in the Rain, dedicated to Annie Briggs and the late Bert Janschke. Plus, the eventful voyage of Eustace the Warthog with Norman Freeman. All that and much more here on Seascapes. Until next Friday night, tight lines, fair sailing.